So welcome, and we're coming in at a point where we've been talking about dukkha. I think there's only one person that was here last week, so I might do a little bit of a review on that, the whole notion of dukkha. It's so central to the teachings on mindfulness or teachings of the Buddha. It's the first noble truth, the understanding and knowing what dukkha is at an intellectual level as well as a felt sense of what it is. And as I said last week, in some ways, Buddhism's got a rap as being, pessimistic, or by some, being very negative. I mean, the first noble truth is like there's suffering, but it really isn't a pessimistic path, because I think, although the first noble truth points out that suffering or a sense of unsatisfactoriness, and I'll go into more about what that word doesn't mean and what it means. Although he says that, he also says there's a cause for the dukkha, and there's a cessation of the dukkha, and there is a path to the cessation of dukkha. So in that way, it's kind of pointing out a reality of our situation and then saying, well, here's where we go from here once we tune into that reality. Now, dukkha, and I'll be very brief because I could give a whole talk about just defining what dukkha is. Often it's translated as suffering, and it's not an exact definition. If you look at the translation directly of the word, and I don't believe I said this last week, which is interesting, it didn't sort of come out of my mouth, it actually means a wheel that's kind of not turning properly, like the wheel of a cart. The axle isn't quite turning properly in the wheel, whether there's dirt in there or it's a little wobbly, it's just off. It's kind of, if you can just picture a wheel not quite turning, that's what it means. So it's kind of like we're not kind of tuned. like I said, the modern day image would be a kind of a piston in an engine that's not firing properly, and your car's kind of going down the road like this. That's what the direct translation of dukkha is. So it's that sense of things are not quite right. There's suffering. There's unsatisfactoriness. There's kind of a dis-ease with the way things are in the world. One teacher I heard said it translated as it's a bummer. And I've heard shit happens as being another one. The bummer one was quite humorous. She read the whole sutta, replaced dukkha with the word bummer. Old age is a bummer. Illness is a bummer. Death is a bummer. Lamentation is a bummer. Not getting what you want is a bummer. Getting too much of what you don't want is a bummer. And the five aggregates of clinging are a bummer. And if that works for you, that's kind of, it's just this sense of things it's not satisfactory, and there's suffering. And I did talk about the different types of dukkha. There's dukkha based on just pain that you experience in life. You stub your toe, you get sick, and so forth. It's called dukkha. It's just based on material conditions. There's a suffering that occurs. The second one is dukkha based on impermanence and change. So the first one is difficulties. The second one is dukkha that arises due to pleasant events. So the sense that it's not going to last, and you know, this craving under all of these, basically craving causes dukkha. I mean, that's the second noble. These are all have to do with craving. Craving for the unpleasant to go away, and not why is this happening? It shouldn't be, you know, I don't want this, pushing it away. And with the dukkha from the second type of dukkha is, you know, seeing something, a beautiful sunset, and just the sense that it's not going to last. And it's an unsatisfactoriness that arises. It's a very subtle sense of, an underlying sense of, it's going to pass. And so it's a subtler, the second type of dukkha is much subtler, and the word suffering doesn't really work in defining it. It's more, I like the word unsatisfactory, or the fact that it's ending is causing this kind of dis-ease in the mind and body. And the third type is sankhara dukkha, which is mental formation. So it's the stuff we add on to the first two that causes more dukkha. So it's the anxiety-filled thoughts and the judgments and the stories that arise based on the first two types of dukkha that we layer on top. And suffering works for that one. And that's the one that we really, you know, I think when we become very dedicated and serious about our practice, we really start to see that one. You know, you something happens in your life that's usually dukkha, you know, the suffering dukkha, and then you sort of sense that, and then the story comes in, oh, I'm so stupid, why did I do that? Or, you know, the self-criticism, whatever it might be, comes in, and all of a sudden the dukkha is minor compared to what you've now, you know, layered on top of it. And we really start to see that when we practice diligently. And follow, you know, follow these teachings. At least for me personally, I really started to see how this mind was just like a storyteller. Like, in fact, I could tell stories about stuff that wasn't even any dukkha. There was nothing. It was like, you know, I put too many. You know, I can remember being at you know, Insight Meditation Society in Barrie at a 7-day retreat. And you know, the mind gets quieter, somewhat quiet, and you're in this place of, you know, stillness and loving kindness. And I took a scoop of peas and put it on my plate, and I looked, and I was quite hungry for some reason. I looked at this big pile of peas, and I looked around, and nobody else in front of me had such a big pile of peas on their plate. Well, the mind just, everybody's going to think you're greedy, a pig, you're, you know, taking all the peas. Oh, the people down there must be thinking, oh, he's eating all the peas, and he's going to. So, you know, the mind created this suffering. I was suffering in that moment. And then, of course, should I put some back? And, you know, that way people are going to think he's putting food back in the, you know, and you're not supposed to do that. So, the story went on. The next thing, I tried to hide the peas with the potatoes, right? Well, if I put this on top, but I had too many potatoes. Anyway, you can see where this, it's just sankhara dukkha. At some point you laugh, right? I mean, this is all mind construct. This is suffering based on mental formations and thoughts and stories. You know, I was able to, at some point in that process, see that, you know, wow, this mind is really, I'm just kind of just watching this mind create this suffering. So that's, in a nutshell, dukkha. And we're to understand, reflect on, and know what this is in our lives. And this is really the first. This is the first. I mean, it's all the Noble Truth stuff, they overlap, and it's not like you do one and then you move on to the next one. You see how craving is causing the suffering. You see how different aspects of it are caused in your life. So you know, you can listen to a talk like this, and you know, I always say that you're not going to really grasp or grok. You know, grok meaning sensing it viscerally or at an experience level from hearing my words. So they're only so useful. Not all that useful in many ways. You have to go practice what's being talked about and go beyond an understanding and really to experience it. So when you're meditating or walking in a circle, to really watch, to notice what's arising, to notice when dukkha based on changing conditions or dukkha based on mental formations is arising. All kinds of things come up when we're just sitting and walking. Stories. When you're walking, what arises? I mean, we're supposed to be, you know, sensing. Often it's sensing the sensation of the foot down the sensation of touch on the floor. Now that's our object of attention generally, and you know, when we're walking, the object of attention is that sensation. It could be also the breath in combination with the sensation of walking. But of course, the mind's going to do all kinds of things with that. From this is stupid, this is weird, why are we doing this? To what do I have to go shopping? I'm too busy to be doing this. You know, all kinds of stuff can come up. I prefer sitting meditation. I prefer yoga. It could, you know. So you just watch this. Watch the mind, and watch when you kind of one grabs you, and see what happens with that. It's all good. It's all like a laboratory to watch. So there's nothing wrong that happens when we're meditating. It's all just. In fact, where we really get to the meat of this is when we experience dukkha. Nobody becomes liberated from suffering without experiencing a lot of suffering. In fact, I can probably safely say that those that really move on the path are those that are experiencing a fair amount of dukkha in their lives. The people I know that are just kind of well adjusted, I mean, just things just seem to go well, and they're not interested in this stuff. Very few of them. Some of them have maybe had a spiritual kind of jolt, like some kind of seeing that they, you know, they have a truth that they just have to pursue. But a lot of times it's based on our difficult circumstances to bring us to this and keep us. That's my story. It's just, you know, suffering that kept bringing me back, and if, you know, I sort of get myself all, you know, leveled out, and boom, again, something would happen. Back to the practice. And this is the story of my life. Up and now, it's just like I'm not leaving it, right? It's somehow been implanted as it is my life, really, at this point, in terms of teaching and practicing. So dukkha is central to our practice. There's a story of Sita Gautami. I don't know if you've heard the story of the woman in the mustard seeds. So Kisa Gautama was a young woman from a wealthy family who was happily married to an important merchant. And when her only son was 1 year old, he fell ill and died suddenly. So Kisa was struck with grief. She couldn't bear the death of her only child. And weeping and groaning, she took her dead baby in her arms and went from house to house begging people in the town for news of a way to bring her son back to life. Of course, you know, nobody could help her with this, but she wouldn't give up. Finally, she came across a Buddhist, and He said, well, go talk to Gautama, the Buddha, and see what he might have to offer you in this. So she carried the dead child to the Buddha and told him her sad story. And he listened with patience and compassion. And then he said to her, Kisa Gautami, there is only one way to solve your problem. Go and find me 4 or 5 mustard seeds from any family in which there has never been a death. So Kisa was filled with hope. She set straight off to find such a household. She went from house to house asking. And very soon she discovered that every family she visited had experienced the death of one person or another. At last she understood what the Buddha had wanted her to find out for herself, that suffering is a part of life and death comes to us all. Once Kisa accepted the fact that death is inevitable, she could stop her grieving. She took the child's body away and later returned to the Buddha and became one of her followers. So the Buddha's message was, part of being human is death, and in fact, it affects all of us. We've all been impacted by death in some way. And broader speaking, his message is part of this human embodiment is that there's difficulties, there's suffering, there's stubbing toes, there's illness, there's old age, death around us. So there is just part of being human. There's no way to avoid it. And there's and pushing it away, trying to either distract ourselves or kind of push it down, causes more suffering. So his path was to accept that this is part of being human. We still try to avoid stubbing our toe. We still try to avoid car accidents or injury, illness. We take medicine when we still do all those things. It's not like supposed to suffer, so I'll do. But when it does happen, you kind of go, okay, yeah, I can see this is part of reality, and there's a sense of easefulness. There can be a sense of easefulness with it. So, you can get some understanding from my words. But ultimately, what the Buddha says is, this noble truth must be penetrated by fully understanding suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me about things not heard before. Excuse me. So what is meant by penetrated? This is key, absolutely key. Because you can read books, you can become a nightstand Buddhist. Where you have always have a couple of books. I often have 4 or 5 on the go at once. So the Dukkha book and the self-compassion book and then the loving kindness book and so you have all the what do I feel like and you can really start to become a lot of stuff in your head. That's not what the Buddha was talking about. By penetrating it, it's again beyond an intellectual understanding. It's to know the nature of suffering directly as a felt experience, and this is why the practice is so key. Joseph Goldstein, a teacher, a highly regarded teacher at Insight Meditation Society, and some of you have probably either read his books or heard of him. is really, really coming back to emphasizing the importance of the daily practice. Getting up in the morning and sitting. And, you know, I know he's always emphasized that, but now he's just like, he's really, really adamant. It's like, if you don't sit, you're not going to get this. Like, he's very blunt. You have to practice, or, you know, all the books you're reading, it's a waste of time. I mean, if you're not practicing. I had a teacher way back, and I think I've told this before, and I was a big reader, right? I'd like to read all the Buddhist books I could. In fact, I had a whole room full of books. I've started giving them away, but I still have 3 bookcases full of books that I can't let go of. And so I'm a real reader. And I had a teacher at one point say, you're only allowed to read for as long as you meditate. Because I was reading like hours and hours. So, geez, I gotta do a lot of meditating if I want to finish all these books I ordered. Right? So it was just a way of saying, you know, reading's fine, but balance it with practice. And I think that's a good, you know, if you're reading it, an hour of Buddhism before you go to bed, then make that an hour, a half an hour of practice and a half an hour of reading. So that's the key to penetrating this, is the practice. Now, of course, it's also bringing that into our daily lives. So that's part of the reason why we sit and then we walk, and then we might do mindful movement, and then the next is, well, just mindful everything. Right? So you're mindful while you're sitting. It's a controlled environment. Your eyes are closed. So like a major sensory sense doors is closed. Just allows you to kind of settle into that, the bare felt experience of what's going on. And then walking is kind of, you know, now your eyes are open. So there's stuff to look around at. And then, I'm also a yoga practitioner, so I find that's another, to do that mindfully with awareness, not as an exercise, but, and then just bringing it into your daily life, bringing that attention to sensory attention to what's arising moment by moment in your daily life. So the Buddha called this dukkha a tangle. I love that. The first time I heard that word is the tangle. A complex of physical and emotional stimuli registering in the brain. So to deconstruct this tangle, we have to really penetrate suffering. We really have to observe to know its true nature. We have to experience it as a physical and mental reality. To really watch. And, you know, so watch when a physical pain arises. Watch when you're looking at a beautiful sunset and the sense of unease arises, very subtle sense of unease, or when you're having a joyful time. It happened this weekend. We had, I was knowing this talk was coming and really watching the arising. Because the unpleasant stuff, it's the subtle, pleasant stuff that really takes a sort of level of attention. So we had these two young second cousins who came to Ottawa for a wedding from Toronto, and they brought a 1-year-old baby. We don't have any grandchildren, so I have older kids, but no grandchildren. Which if you're listening, I'd like to have some grandchildren. When they're ready, right? So we had this baby, and beautiful baby, you know, just so engaging. And just really enjoying. So they went to the left us with the baby. They were in the wedding. She was in the wedding party, so they were at the. They were gone the whole weekend, right, at different things. So we were with this baby all the time, and just so engaging. Like, it just loved people, a very, you know, friendly baby. And I was just, you know, really enjoying being with this baby. And then I know, this baby's going to be gone. it's only here for 2 days. And I just felt this real discontent, this unsatisfactoriness. This is impermanent. This little being is not going to be here Sunday afternoon. And, you know, it kind of even, I felt it deeply when I allowed it, right? As soon as I allowed it, and then I could let it be, let it process it and let it be. But just really sensing that, penetrating the nature of that disease that arises. Here's a quote from Lama Suridas. That Lama, have you heard of? He's got lots of books like Buddha Standard Time and his latest one. And I forget the names of the other. Very easy reading. Enjoyable to read books about Buddhist, a Western American Lama. So this is what he says about dukkha. How much we suffer depends on us, our internal development, and our spiritual understanding and realization. Our pain and suffering point out to us where we're most attached to ourselves, our body, for example, or to our loved ones. It shows us what we are holding on to the most. By recognizing this, we can learn to use loss and suffering in ways that help us grow wiser and become at peace with ourselves and the universe. So it's a way to penetrate and deconstruct loss and suffering that allows us to grow wiser, develop our wise understanding, wise view, and hence become more at peace with what's arising moment to moment within ourselves and the world. A little comic strip. I thought little comics. So it's two. Not sure what a dog and a person. Looks like they're lying on a slope of a roof. See the little roof they're lying on, and the person says, "Life is like a bowl of cherries." And the dog says, "How so? I hate cherries." So we don't always get what we want. That Forrest Gump said, "Life is like a box of chocolates." You never know what you're going to get. You know, famous line from a wonderful film. So we're being with what's difficult, and noticing if reactivity arises, if judgment arises, if craving arises. And this means more. This can be confusing for some people. You know, I've students say, "Well, you know, I do that. I disagree. You know, I really watch what's arising." I say, "Okay," and I even label it. I say, "Okay, you know, pain in my knee. Thought about pain in my knee. I'm registering everything that's arising moment to moment. Is this it? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing?" So it's kind of a mental recognition of difficulties, of unsatisfactoriness or difficulties as they arise. That question, they're not really sure what embodying the experience means. Because it's more than a mental recognition. It's a real embodiment. It's really staying connected with it, with the heart, if that makes sense for some people. Staying connected, heart connected with it, as well as mind connected with it, body connected with it, being awake, fully awake to what's happening, to what's there, whether we like it or not. And sometimes with our mental recognition, we're recognizing things, and all of a sudden, something comes up that there's a real aversion, and then the mental recognition kind of goes off the rails a little bit. With the heart embodied experiencing of it, the visceral experiencing of it, it's a little less likely for that to go off the rails that easy, because you're really letting it in, and you'll feel it. You'll really feel it. You can even feel the heart tightening and opening, and for me a real physical sense. It's a more physical sense for me than a mental. I think that's why that word embodying is so helpful, because it's in the body. I think I could safely say more so than in the mind. It's in the body. And of course, this is not always easy if we're facing great difficulties in life. I'd say, this practice can be going along, and some real physical illness, or some real loss of a loved one, and so there are very difficult emotions that arise in our life, and we face great difficulties. And we do what we can to bring an embodied presence to it all. Last week, somebody asked what the opposite of dukkha was. And at first I answered, talking about, in the sense of the cessation of dukkha being the opposite. But there's actually a word, the word sukha, which is, more accurately, the opposite, which occurred to me after the question was asked again, what he was actually asking. And it's sukha is happiness or ease or bliss or pleasure. The happiness that arises with a more extensive attitude towards life, to not kind of thrown hither and fro with the incidents of in our daily life, at work and at home. Just being able to say yes to different experiences in life, both the glad, the happy ones, and the sad ones. To being able to be with the moment. And I guess recognizing that we learn from all situations that arise in our life. I say with all honesty, I learned the most in my life from the most difficult physical injury that I experienced, which took away my capacity to my mental capacity with multiple concussions. I was, I lost my ability to think, to even balance myself. That's sort of how bad it was, But I looking back, and at the moment, this is horrible. Like, why did this happen? I didn't think I'd be able to live through it. But now I look, and that's I'll say this, and like, that's the best thing that ever happened to me. It might sound corny, but it's true. And it's the period. It's what was responsible for the most growth. So learning from all the situations that we might find ourselves in. And there's three kinds of sukha. I don't know if you want. They're interesting. So there's sukha that comes from sense pleasures. So, a good meal, smelling roses, whatever, a beautiful person, whatever you consider, whatever sense pleasures. So those, that's one type of sukha. There's sukha that comes from meditative states. So if you're familiar with the jhanas at all, the deep absorptions that you can get into with a highly concentrated, absorbed mind. Very blissful states that can arise, that can get addicted to. You can like, woo, and you want them back. It's like, if you have an addictive personality, stay away from the jhanas. The jhanas can be like, they can pull you in for years, right? They're considered one of the types of sukhas. So they're a temporary, and it's very important. The jhanas are a temporary blocking of the what the Buddha calls the defilements or greed, hatred, and delusion. It's a temporary blocking of the greed, hatred, and delusion. Because by focusing the mind on a single object, everything else, is falls away. So there's a real calming, and you can sit there for hours. A lot of times, and I've talked to monks, I've stayed with monks for a while, and they would sit for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, and from like 3 o'clock in the morning till, and they were in jhanic states. So if you try and do that, practicing, choiceless awareness, you just like, eventually, you sit that long, your mind starts to go into jhanic state, especially when you're with a bunch of monks that are in a jhanic state, because there's an energy. Believe me, there's an energy that gets sent out into the room. That's, I think, a practice of many long people that sit for long, long periods of time and they're just moving. You wonder, how the heck did they do that? I mean, one is your body gets used to sitting, but just sitting without moving a muscle for so long. Like, their sittings were an hour and a half, and then, walk around once like we just did and sit for another hour and a half. It's like, whoa. But, it's the mind is just in an altered state. It really is an altered state. So that's it, and it's temporary. So a lot of people have these jhanic experiences and think, you can actually think you're enlightened. You can get so deep, and you can say, "Wow, this is it!" And your mind can actually tell, "I'm enlightened. This is it. This just happened. I saw like all this stuff." So outside your regular experience. Anyway, I won't go into the jhanic. It's a whole series of talks in itself. And the last one is nirvanic sukha. It's enlightenment. It's a permanent cessation of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And there's a total disassociation from the sense pleasures. I mean, in a sense, you experience them and you might enjoy them, but there's no like craving or pushing away. There's just like allowing. There's just being with whatever's arising, moment to moment, and it's a kind of a permanent. It is a permanent state. But you can take it, I say this to people, that's never going to happen to me. I mean, happened to Buddha and maybe people that sit for, these monks I'm talking about, maybe it'll happen to them. But it can happen like that to anybody, first of all, and you're already awake, you just don't know it. But second of all, the other is, you get taste of this. In your daily life, you really can get taste of this sense of just an allowing and letting go, and just being with the arising and falling away of a phenomenon. And you get a real taste, and that's really what motivates many to practice. This taste that we get that. Quite fulfilling and very peaceful and useful. So Ajahn Sumedho is a wonderful monk he's a quotable monk. He seems to say all these quotable quotes. It's a sense of this moment is like this. As my teacher Nazi Flickstein says, just this. and this and this. It's just this. There's no, you know, layering on top of it. It's just being with the way things are. Of course, it doesn't mean we don't again operate. We operate in this world. We still do things. We're just allowing whatever's arising. The suchness of the moment. Tathagata. This is what the Buddha called himself. And have you heard that? Tathagata is the one who's, you know, Buddha is the one who is awake. Tathata refers to the suchness of the moment, with the way things are. So it's the one who is with the way things are, with the suchness of the moment. That word makes sense. The first time I heard suchness of the moment, but if that for some people it makes sense, just the way things are. That's what he called himself, the Buddha, Tathagata. And when we do that, so even when we signal our willingness to be with the way things are, there's a shift. Just that intention, there's a mysterious shift that occurs. It's a pointing out of our willingness to be transformed. So it's an allowing. It's allowing this process to begin. And also, you know, so setting that intention and beginning that process, being with our experience, just being with our experience, we're signaling our willingness to be transformed, to go along the path. It ignites this kind of mysterious, really indescribable process that I'm trying to describe, right, with words, because that's what we have to communicate. Just being with the suchness of the moment. The visceral nature of experience, or direct experience rather than the thought-created reality that we often live in. We live in a thought-created reality most of the time. Just really watch that. Watch the mind. It's amazing to see this thought-created reality that we live in, that we create, layer on, create some more. And when that even stops for a few moments, what can emerge in that space is amazing. Mysterious and amazing, what emerges into that space. Seeing the truth of things. Seeing a headache. What does seeing the truth of a headache look like? Often we get a headache. Oh, damn, I got a headache. I got this big meeting. I got to be on. What am I going to, if I take drugs, I'll be all dull from the ibuprofen or whatever it is. Maybe a story about how important this meeting, I'm just giving you an example. It could be anything, but that's not being with the headache. That's reacting to the physical sensation. So being with the headache can be being with the tingling or swirling sensations that arise of sensation, seeing it changing. Seeing the movement of it, seeing if a thought arises about it. Maybe a thought doesn't arise about it. Maybe you can just hold your awareness into that with physical sensations, tingling, swirling, whatever it might be. You don't have to label them tingling, swirling. You can just, I mean, some people do that, when, especially when they're starting this process. They may say, tingling, swirling. Or, you may just be at the point where you're just with those sensations. If a thought arises about it, then just noticing that. If a thought, a judgment arises about having the thought, just noticing that. And just being with that, the truth of things as they're arising. It's that simple. Of course, it takes practice. When I had my headaches from my concussions, I wanted to get rid of them. Right? So, and I was even told, go back to your meditation practice, it'll help you get rid of them. What they meant was, what I heard was, if I meditate, I'll get rid of it. So it was a resistance. It wasn't a being with. It was a resistance. So then I was told, well, no. Remember, my mind's not really clear either, so I could only remember very simple instructions. It would be like teaching a toddler to meditate, because I could only take very simple instructions. So then I was told that, if you're pushing it away, what you resist persists. Oh, that's what I got. So then I thought, well, I'll just allow it, and then it'll go away. So I'm glad I saw lots of smiles, because there's such a subtle, there's still the fix it. It's just how I'm fixing it. Now I'm allowing it to get it. So there's an underlying resistance, right? It's like I'm trying to con myself. And I went through that for quite a while, right? And I don't know if this rings for other people, or am I the only one that's experienced this? But, and I sat, and the word that I like to use to describe being with the is surrender. Because it's at one point, and I remember the point, I said, I can't do this. I give up. I can't fight with this anymore. The sensations were there. I was just with them. And of course, it started to dissolve, right? Then the mind came in and goes, you got it figured out. So then I had to start over, right? But I knew at that moment there was a possibility to be with it in a different way, at a very visceral level, even though the mind jumped in. It was a moment of liberation, really. So that's what we're talking about when we're just being with the suchness, with the truth of the way things are, at a very visceral, embodied level. So I'll open it up to any dialogue, questions, or about that talk, or about anything else actually that has arisen for you in your life, or your meditation practice. Open it up for questions. And we have this little protocol, I guess you'd call it. So when we begin to talk, before we begin, we go like this. That signals to everyone that you're going to say something, and then when we all recognize you. And then when you're finished, you also go like this. That way you can kind of pause. Sometimes the dialogue gets a little back and forthy, and it falls apart a little bit, but that's okay too. It's always respectful, and that's kind of what we're after with the with that guideline. So yeah, I'll just open it up to folks.
Hello, surf.
Can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf.
And it's just kind of a reflective process. And I started with, okay, we're going to just sit with pretty little direction. Just when you put yourself away, it can be cost and effort. So, giggles, of course, and shuffling around, etc. But each day I've persisted. And it's to the point where they ask, can we do this for you? So I have no opportunities. But the two students that have benefited the most, it's kind of interesting, is one of the and a student has Asperger's. And they're the ones who have done it. I'm not preaching, but it was just, I already call it meditation. But what did you notice? And the level of reflection and things that come out of the brain. I noticed that when everyone's quiet, I can hear this, so I can feel the sense of this body. So it's a bit of a social experiment.
Yeah, we'll see where it goes. I mean, it could go to many more minutes. Grade 7 and 8, you said?
Yeah, this particular class is grade 7, just because I have an understanding.
Yeah.
And because there's lots of needs to be it seems, I've heard before, and I've firsthand tried it, it's good with people taking it, it's a good way to center the focus. Initially, we're felt a year ago on some level, and I didn't say, I said, you can look right if you want. I said, if we're looking at each other, I said, maybe just want to look at some kind of desk, or if there's something on the wall, I'm trying to maybe say stuff, basically.
Yeah.
And now, kids are starting to look at we've got 2 minutes and 30 seconds over the keyboard, so.
Wonderful.
It's been a hard thing to accept that suffering is so intentional. But I'd almost say that there's almost an equation that the deeper the suffering, the more of it. For the last year and a half, I expected to have depression. And what I wanted, especially early on, is just for depression to go away, to go back to my so-called normal, ordinary life. But somewhere along the way, it wasn't so long ago, right? I was on a retreat, a week-long retreat, and I went back into depression. It kind of like a horrible experience, the worst possible thing that could happen to me. I don't care. But I stayed with him, and I was talking to a friend at the end, and she said, with the recurring depression, you have to make a new path to record. Your old life, going back to your old life, it's the life that makes you depressed. And, at first, I was just very painful, very difficult. But I began to see the truth in that. That I really had been holding on to, not even my old life, but I had a fantasy of my old life. house in the country with the horses. And, you know, I think I didn't even want my children to grow up. You know, I want everything to stay the same. And I realized over a fairly short period of time, I was really lucky to work with friends. I mean, he's a coach, but professionally in office, the coach in a period of transition, you know, for free to focus the book. And I realized, you know, like, to make any sense from these things, I have to tell them. I have to move into town with my kid, Hilmer. And I've been a freelancer for years, and that didn't make sense. It didn't. Kids from home, his wife was around, you know, but I need to get him out. And it only period of about 4 weeks, I said, no, I fixed my house up, painted it from top to bottom. I, you know, got it ready to be shown, and I wrote the description of it. I haven't done any of that, so I wrote the description of the house. And I said, yeah. And by then, I said, no. And I went to people that I had been freelancing for, and I said, I want you guys to hire me. I don't want to do freelance anymore. And they said, okay. So I've changed a lot of things in my life. And I realized that me will continue. That, you know, that is, like, for example, I've been diagnosed as bipolar 2, which, I mean, whether it's helpful as a metaphor or something else, whatever. But one thing that I see is that when I'm in a down phase, I know things that don't work. Like, I know that this works, and I'm just in the bed for 2 hours, although I can't do it. It doesn't work. I don't need to see that again. This doesn't work. So this week, what I've been doing is getting up at the same time every day, no matter how much or how little sleep I get, which would be a few hours sleep. And I've been riding my bike part of the way in town because I haven't really been exercising for years. And I have to keep doing that. It's great. It's a great pleasure that I've been taking this work. So, and then I'm doing other things too. There's a group in Ottawa called the Men's Project to help men who traumatize these children. My story. So I'm going to this program. I was going to go to more to meet therapists for the time, assessment. And I sat myself down, you know, not always, but often, curious and interested. Even with depression coming out, like today, I got a call from Will Davis, and I knew what it was about. I didn't have the final kind of financial thing for my house. And there was a possibility, extremely distant, that it wouldn't go through. And so I didn't call him back right now. Instead, I just sat there for a while and just felt this cascade of stuff going through my mind and my body, anxiety and dread and hope. So, and then I did call him. Yeah, I told him. So the thing I'm saying is, you know, my old life was a life but I really get how inauthentic my life was. And I also understand why, you know. Really painful, difficult stuff that I didn't know how to touch. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't have a clue. I've been a therapist. I've gone into therapy for years. So, this process, becoming more authentic, can be excruciatingly painful. But I see that the alternative is much, much easier. It's really hopeless.
let's end with a just a couple minute sit.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.